Is the mic on?
Yes.
Oh, great. All right. Hi, I'm Sean Garrity with OmniLink Systems, and today we're going to talk about what software can learn from the world of magic. I'm not a magician, but I've been a fan my whole life, and I'd like to look at some of the methods that they use. First of all, magicians get design. They understand that there's a theme to their shows, to their tricks. They have a banter or patter that you can actually think of as like content strategy. They all have a theme. And the other thing, too, is that the style of the magician matches their type of magic. So if you think of Penn & Teller or Lance Burton or David Copperfield or Chris Angel or even a street magician, they all have their own particular style. The other thing, too, is that they understand showmanship. Of the five external senses, they work primarily with sight and sound and sometimes touch. And we have the exact same corollary in the world of software. And we even have more with touch these days. They will practice a trick for decades, and they'll sit on it until it's ready. And once it is ready, then they will incorporate kind of a feedback loop so that the trick is constantly improved and upgraded over time. They understand that there's certain elements of flow to a show, and they have fluid movements, and they incorporate timing so that the audience can enjoy the show. In 1939, there is a gentleman by the name of Daryl Fitzke, and he wrote a book, actually a trilogy of books called the Fitzke Trilogy, strangely enough. And in one of the books called Showmanship for Magicians, he talks about 35 elements of showmanship. And those could be things like appeal, punch, thrill. And if you think about it, it would be kind of nice to consider, you know, take some of these into consideration when we're making our software. The other thing, too, is that to magicians, magic is not arcane knowledge. It's really just deception to them. They know what devices are being used. It's either skill or some sort of device that they can employ to make the spectator come along. Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently advanced technology is, Mike?
Indistinguishable from magic.
Yes, indistinguishable from magic. And if you think about it, that's true. You know, 10 years ago, geolocation was almost like black voodoo magic. But now it's very commonplace. We all know what it is. And the other thing, too, we have more magical devices entering our world these days, especially since we all got Kinects the other day. In 2009, Mr. Barraza did a wonderful demonstration with the emotive headset and a WPF. But the thing, he incorporated these visual cues that provided this magical effect. The other thing that magicians do really well is they understand attention. They know how to get it. They know how to hold it. They know that there's only a short amount of time that we actually do get attention. They anticipate things, so they may do something prior to the trick or something after your attention is gone. And they also understand the difference in magic performances. If I'm doing magic with someone one-on-one, the spectator controls their sight. And we have the exact same parallel with mobile devices. We control that. However, on stage magic or on televised magic, they actually have the cameras that are shooting from one direction or another, so they manage perspective. And we need to do the same thing in our 10-foot displays. They understand the importance of brevity. They keep it short, and they quit when you've had enough. And they appeal to the instincts and not the mind. And they make the spectator relaxed so that they know they can enjoy the show. Some tools that they use are misdirection. And in misdirection, simulation and dissimulation are one. Simulation is actually making something appear to be a certain way, while dissimulation is hiding the true state. There's a trick called the French drop, and I remind you, I'm not a magician, but they take a coin, they'll grab it, and then they make it disappear. Well, really, it's in this hand. You know, any kid can do that. But the nice thing about this trick is there's so many elements from the software world, right? So one thing is that they have this natural movement, and then in that natural movement is also elements of easing. So they start out quick, and they finish slow, and they use a small flourish so that it's not overt. And the other great thing that they do is they provide a secondary visual cue by the magician so that I'm following my own hand and the spectators will automatically follow that hand too, because that's my point of interest. In the world of software, simulation is the equivalent of drag and drop. We're not actually pulling a file across a desk, we're just changing the address. And we also use this simulation where we load long-running components in the background so they don't appear to be there, but they actually are there. So when we're ready to use it, it's ready to go. Suggestion and inducement. Suggestion is the subtle positive act of putting a thought in the mind of the spectator. And by doing this, the magicians kind of bring the spectator into their own reality. And the fabulous thing about that is they never say, I have an ordinary magic hat. They take out a real-world object, and with that real-world object, they're like, okay, I have a deck of cards. Automatically, everyone in the audience is thinking, there's four suites, there's 52 cards. If I open it up and spill it on the ground, they're affected by gravity. So just by going from here, as humans, we automatically make connections. So one of the nice things about suggestion, and we see it on the surface unit, when there's photos scattered about, automatically we think, oh, well, I can move this here, I can make this bigger, I can play around with it. With inducement, Twitter does this when you sign up. So if you follow three people, they'll show you can follow another seven. With maneuver and ruse, the maneuver is the management and manipulation of circumstances. So they'll hold a card deck a certain way the whole time. They'll work with props a certain way. And with the ruse, you actually hide the purpose of what you're doing. There's a magician by the name of Apollo Robbins called he's the gentleman thief. He does put pocketing and pickpocketing. And he will move into the space of the spectator, and he doesn't move in directly. He moves in next to them so that automatically they don't know what his true purpose is. Meanwhile, he's stealing their wallet, their watch. He's giving it to someone behind. And there's some great videos of him working with that. With monotony and confusion, monotony is the act of repetition. And they use this over and over again until the spectator becomes relaxed with what they're working with. And we have this every day, right? So every day I take my phone, I plug it in, and I'm syncing it up so I can get my latest podcast. But really what's happening in the background is it's taking up a backup. So, you know, next year when the latest and greatest comes out, I need to upgrade, or should my phone fail, then magically my phone's restored. Confusion is a great tool for magicians. However, it's not really great for us because it creates this cognitive load. But you can remove confusion, and by doing that, you'll make a better experience. I forgot to mention that they work with external senses, but also internal senses. So remember that when you're working with your software. So were you looking at me, or were you looking at the lady in the red dress? Two other items that they use are distraction and diversion. Diversion is taking attention away from the item that is of importance and introducing a new and more interesting factor so that they have a misdirection factor there. Distraction is where you actually force the attention away. With diversion, we use this tactic in form development, right? So you get through a form, you're going through it. When you finish, we actually have the primary state or the primary action highlighted, or some way it has something visual that draws you to it. With distraction, the classic example of this is modal dialogues, pop-ups. You're literally forcing the attention away from what they were working on to something new. Who likes cards? Anybody? There you go. So I'd like to finish with a great quote from The Prestige. And here I'll read it. The secret impresses no one. The trick you use it for is everything. And in the world of software, we could think of this, actually. The technology you use impresses no one. The experience you create with it is everything. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Arturo Toledo, and I want to share an experience with you that I've been going through in the last few months since I started getting involved in the world of stock trading. As part of my immersion in this world, I started using all sorts of different tools and software to help me trade. One thing that I quickly realized is that the experience of trading with these tools was merely transactional, and it wasn't really helping me do a better job as a trader or increase my profits for that matter. And so with design arrogance, honestly, I said, hey, I can do way better than all these people. I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to create my own software to do stock trading portfolio management. And so I started sketching some ideas, and I came up with wireframes and some comps, and I put together some user scenarios, and basically following a very traditional user-centric design approach. After a few weeks, I looked at my screen, and I realized that I was getting to the very same type of solution that I was complaining about just a few weeks ago, which is typical. And so it was, you know, I was probably using a better use of typography, nicer layout, but it was really just lipstick on a pig, a pretty-looking Excel spreadsheet, which is, by the way, what most traders use as their portfolio management software. And so I stepped back and I said, hey, if I really want to do something innovative, I have to first understand as a user what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking when I'm in front of the screen. And that's something that without any psychology background, it's really hard to do. I think everyone here will agree that sometimes we think and feel things, we don't really know why we're going through that. Those same days, I was reading a book by Dr. Alexander Elder. He's a psychologist turned stock trader, very popular instructor. And one of the things that he says is that traders deal with only two emotions, greed and fear. So he simplified my world by allowing me to focus on these two particular emotions. Even though that helped a little bit, I was still unsure why I was feeling greedy or fearful sometimes. And so I even started, you know, thinking maybe I just wasn't born for this. Maybe I just wasn't made to do stock trading. And so I turned to the almighty internet and I asked the internet, show me the gene of fear. You know, maybe it comes along with my heritage. But it turns out that researchers found, just in 2005, a gene for fear. It's a gene on chromosome number 1 that manages a substance called stathmin. Now, it's also the name of the gene. The stathmin helps us regulate our fear. Dr. Shumyatsky, one of the members of the team, tells in his blog some of the experiments that they did. And one of the ones that caught my attention for user interface and experience design was that they had a cage, and in this cage, they had a mouse. On the other side of the cage, they would give a delicious little bit of drink to the mouse. So the mouse would be encouraged to look for pleasure. Now, the floor was electrified, and it would give random electroshocks to mice. I know we humans are jerks sometimes. But we would test the mouse, and so what they did is they knocked down the gene for stathmin on this mouse. So the mouse had no ability to measure risk and was lacking fear completely and would go after and after in search for the pleasure, of course, going through a lot of pain. There was another mouse who was left untouched in its genes, and that mouse quickly learned to manage risk and learned that if he did that, it would, you know, get through a lot of pain. So I started thinking, how can I translate this into some experienced metaphor and user interface solution that could help traders? And I realized that we've all in this room, most possibly, who has played Minesweeper? Right, everyone. So Minesweeper, I realized that the mechanics of this game was extremely, if not the same as the experiment that we just heard. If we've played Minesweeper, I'm sure, you know, when you click one of those cells and you get a bunch of numbers, don't you feel good? You feel that pleasure, right? You hit one of those cells and you get the bomb, and oh my God, it feels like hell, right? It feels pain. But that's why this game is so addictive. And so I said, let's translate this metaphor into UX. And so I came up with this idea of creating a grid of trading opportunities. The other concept that I learned throughout this process is that numbers like what we have on the screen, $12,812.08, is a hard number for the human brain to grasp. And so I said, let's abstract money into fixed investment amounts of, say, $10,000, which will equal something I'm calling an egg. And so if you have $120,000 investment, that's 12 eggs that you can play with. These eggs will be going through different stages of evolution and you know, maturity, depending on how your trade is behaving. Here we can see the grid, how it started evolving on our exploration for user interface. And you can see that now we have more space and room to accommodate other needs, like perhaps different sectors or industries in the stock market. And here we start laying out our eggs, which is also a way for us to have a spatial view of how we are keeping our portfolio diversified. Now, the other experiment that I found very interesting came from Dr. Eric Kendall. He's a Nobel Prize winner for his research on Alzheimer's disease. And in the early 2000s, he came up with this experiment where he would put a rat to swim in a small pool. This is something called a Morris water navigation test. So the rat starts swimming and swimming and swimming, looking for an exit. When it cannot find an exit, it starts getting depressed, and it starts just floating. That would eventually lead to its death. Now, Dr. Kendall said that Prozac would help the rat continue to swim, take it out of the depression. Now, as a stock trader, I seriously don't want to have to start taking Prozac. But luckily, and bless Dr. Kendall, he came up with an alternative solution, which is that he trained rats with something he called a safe sound. It was just a tic-tac that he would play and train them when the rats were in a safe environment. So the next time that the rat got depressed, they played the sound, the tic-tac, and the rat continued to swim, which was a breakthrough in science on how these alternative mechanisms to get the best out of your brain. So here we can see the same UI. Now we can see some of the eggs have been evolving, some better than others. But now I'm noticing that, I was just watching CNBC, as many stock traders. I'm starting to get worried about one of my trades. Maybe I just read a couple tweets that are making me start feeling, kind of confused and maybe really scared about maybe just selling my trade. But this is when the software realizes that I might be having gone through a series of losses recently, and it knows that maybe I'm checking this trade too often, so it's allowing me to relax with this sound that I've been training with myself on the weekends. The idea here is that every person can choose their own sound. This is something that I find very relaxing. So I'm really planning to use that very soon. Let's talk now about greed. So I went and looked for the gene of greed. Maybe I'm just too greedy. It turns out that there is no gene for greed specifically, but there is something called dopamine. Now, dopamine is a hormone that gets segregated by the amygdala, which lives in our midbrain. It turns out that our midbrain is the oldest part of our brain, the part of our brain that has been, the longest. And that blew my mind away, thinking that with all the sophistication, all the screens, the multi-million-dollar accounts, the fanciness that revolves around Wall Street, we're still being driven by the same thing that drove us 100,000 years ago when our ancestors went hunting for mammoths. So the experiment that really caught my attention here was this one. Again, rats, poor rats. One day they'll come back. A group of researchers created this brain interface device. And this device, this little computer, had three connectors into the brain of the rat. Two of them were connected to the part of their brain that sends touch on the left or the right whiskers. And so that would tend to move the rat to the left or to the right. Now, the magic comes with the third connector, which was plugged into the amygdala of the mouse. So when the mouse was doing what the computer was saying, if it was going to the right or to the left, the mouse would literally be given a boost of happiness, right? It would stimulate the amygdala, segregate dopamine, and literally the mouse, or the rat in this case, was excited to do what the computer was telling it to do. This is kind of a freaky thing, right? But I realized that that's really what I need to do to traders. And so some of us might have whiskers, maybe others don't, but I realized that the learning thing here is that the brain is trained and learns patterns. And what I realized is that all the trading software that I have been using so far was rewarding me for the wrong things, starting with colors, which is a direct application to user interface. Green, when I see green, I immediately read, you're a winner, you're doing great, you're going to be a millionaire, you should buy more stock of this particular company, right? When I see red, I see you're a loser, you should be selling, you should be in panic. So the first thing I realized is I started stripping it down, making it much more abstract and neutral, and also taking out some of the iconography like arrows and other things and cleaning it up all the way till I go to something like this. This is basically a progress bar. What I want to train myself and other traders on is to trade their plan, to be disciplined in what they said they were going to do. And so this is a very different approach for rewarding people for how much money they make. Here's a little bit of an exploration of a UI. This UI that would help you trade stocks. It doesn't have red or green colors to show you're doing good or bad. It's just green when you're still within the range of your plan. So it encourages discipline. The other research that I found very interesting, Dr. Miriam J. Tuck from the University of Twente in the Netherlands published a research where they found that with a full bladder, humans could actually have better impulse control and take better financial decisions. Now, I really, like with Prozac, I don't want to have to start drinking water 40 minutes before I trade, right? So luckily, Dr. Miriam was also very smart and came up with an alternative solution, which is actually kind of an urban myth, right? But it turns out it's real. Providing suggestive images, videos, sounds about water flowing puts your mind into a similar state. And so I found some interesting textures that I would incorporate into the UI. And this one I have to click here. But the idea here is to integrate some of these textures into the user interface. And again, one thing I learned throughout this process of immersing myself in neuroscience is that our brain loves to feel and loves to get all these stimuli in a very subtle way, right? And sorry if I'm making someone want to leave now. But the brain really wants to have fun. And it's been a really amazing experience to get deeper into neuroscience. It's been changing the way that I see design and even my own life. And I really have no doubt that between neuroscience and genetics, the biggest design decisions will be made in the next couple decades. Thank you very much.
The year is 1981, and three people are standing on stage in Stockholm, Sweden. They're about to receive a split Nobel Prize that year in the field of medicine. One of those men is this man, Dr. Roger Sperry. Now, if you're an artist or if you're a designer, even if you're just left-handed, this man has had a profound influence on your life and how the world sees you, because this is the man that answered the question, what in the world is the right brain good for? It's because of his early work in the 60s that we were able to start answering that question. Because really before that time, if you were left-handed, you're kind of little in that odd boat, right? But this guy and his team and the people that followed after him really started addressing that. And since that, we've had this avalanche of drawing on the right side of the brain, which is a well-loved book to many of us who have design or drawing in our background, right? More recently, Daniel Pink, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. And we have this big avalanche of it's right brain, it's right brain, it's right brain. It's this guy that you can thank for. And as creatives, we're usually like, yay, the world loves us now. There's a place for us. And we usually don't care how the sausage was made. But here's the dirty secret of what actually happened. Because how do you go about doing this in the early 60s with that level of Don Draper morality? Well, the United States, as well as most civilized countries, they usually have this pesky little, they look down upon radical human experimentation, right? So if you're really smart, you get creative. And so maybe you go to a group of people who suffer severely from grand mal seizures. And you explain to that group your seizures starting at one part of the brain and going all through your brain. So what we're going to do is we're just going to cut your brain in half. And it'll stop the circuit and your life will be improved. So is that safe? We're doctors. The interesting thing about this, though, is at this point, they now had what they could really use, a test group that they could test and test and test again. And it's really because of this early work that they were able to map, okay, the right brain to the left hand. By targeting the left hand and left eye, they could start testing directly into the right hemisphere and vice versa. Probably one of the most interesting experiments, most famous ones, was this one. They would propose a problem that today we all realize is a very classical right hemisphere problem. It's visual problem solving. They'd put a pattern to one of these split brain patients and they'd say, redo this pattern. And even if the split brain patient was right-handed, their left hand would fly out and do the problem. Easy peasy. The right hand, though, which had come from the traditional smart left side of the brain, could not do this problem. In fact, left hand would start coming out and trying to put its own two cents in, like designers kind of want to throw an input whenever developers are working on problems, right? They'd actually make them sit on their left hand so that they could test the right hand. But when things got really weird was when they let them use both hands. And when they stopped sitting on their left hand, instead of the hands working together, the hands actually would start fighting. So the right hand would start building a solution, and the left hand would knock down that solution and start taking the block. And it would pick up a block, and the other hand would start struggling for the blocks. And it was blowing them away. And this is where we really had that aha moment, in that we do not have one brain. We have two brains. We have two processors in our brain, and they do not work together. They do not work the same way, especially if you've had your corpus callosum cut, right? For any problem you have, the right brain will go big picture down to details. The left brain will go details and try and build up to a big picture. This is how they work. And if you do not have a high, powerful influencer that can integrate that in together, you're going to be having this conflict and this tension and this fighting for dominance. And so, of course, if we're talking about conflict and tension and fighting for dominance, of course it leads us to football, right? And I know what you're thinking at this point. Rick, I know you. Look at you. What do you know about football, right? And I stand here proudly and I tell you, I don't know jack about football. But I know an awful lot about movies. And everything I've learned about football, I've learned from movies. And there's one golden rule in football movies that makes it important. So when it hit me 10 years ago, when I'm watching that paragon of masculine, left-brain logic problem-solving, Gene Hackman, and he's talking to dreamy-eyed, left-handed Keanu Reeves, who just can't seem to get the problem. And he gives him that sage piece of developer-grounded advice. And he says, son, when the game's on the line, winners want the ball. And it just hit me like that torpedo of truth, right, at that moment. And I was like, that's it. That's why people like me, hybrids, don't have a place right now in software. This was 10 years ago. Because we pose an aggressive threat to the traditional landscape that we've all been taught. Because designers and developers both don't like us. Because everybody now wants the ball. And we're trying to step in as like a third team on a football field. And it's just not working. However, the landscape has been changing. From Web 1.0 to Web 2.0, we've been fueled by this runaway freight train of technology, right? And Moore's Law, and things are getting richer and richer, and the user expectations are getting higher and higher. And we're entering this new landscape where a radically aggressive statement such as this, if you can't build it, you have no business designing it, is starting to be more and more true. And traditional design agencies are getting scared. Traditional development agencies are getting scared. Not everybody here is a hybrid. I think we all kind of know the ratios, right? A lot of developers, few designers, even fewer hybrids. But how many of us here, by a show of hands, work for a company that now in 2011 is attempting to try and do both design and development, offer those as our services? We can see this as a show of hands. Can you guys just look around the room for a little bit right now? This is not a talk about the future, it's a talk about the present, because this is where software development is right now. And we are trying to be out there and bring in these hybrid agencies. We're all doing this and we're all struggling with this. And the challenge is that it brings conflict against this traditional pattern that we've been raised with. Right brain designers on one side of the wall and left brain, sorry, I got my wires crossed. Left brain developers on the other side of the wall, and it's this tension for the ball and how's it going to happen and all this types of stuff, right? And a lot of us who are right there in the middle, we're getting it from both sides. We don't know what's going on, right? But this is how we've been taught. The sad thing is that designers and developers both want the same thing. They want to ship a great product. They want to ship something that works. In fact, design is too important to be left only to the designers. They both care about design. It's just that designers tend to prioritize what we call visceral design. It's that 10-second wow. What's that visceral response when you first see it? When you see something, how does it make you feel? That's what we tend to prioritize before we get down to the other stuff. Whereas developers, usually maligned as not caring about design, they do care about it. They generally care about reflective design, which is when the person walks in and they look back at it. Did a blue screen of death on them? That's actually a design decision, and it's very important. And all of these represent grown-up, great design. Because at the end of the day, we have to remember design is both a noun and a verb. And in the software industry, we usually only talk about design as a noun. What's the design of the product? And often that's simplified down to what's the style of the product, right? But great design is first and foremost about solving the right problem. Just as importantly, it's about doing it efficiently. And of course, doing it with style, as much style as a solution should afford, no more and no less. But this is the spectrum of great design. And we've seen this reaction already, because we've seen all these new roles popping up trying to address this very conflict that we're talking about. We have these roles that are popping up, and we have all these different types of things. Now, I know this is Microsoft conference, so let me put this in a way that might be a little bit more geeky friendly. So when we think about these roles and how they're visualized, right, we have the very elegant Orlando Bloomy graphic designers, and it's so beautiful, and their fonts are so light and delicate. You kind of have this new hobbity UX role that's walking around. It's like more fuzzy than an elf, but not quite statuesque yet to be a developer, and they're going to be sure what's going on. And they're usually the ones that have to carry the ring, right? You have the royal legacy of the developers, and honestly, they are king. At the end of the day, the project usually does stand or fall on the technical lead, and they carry that to the end, and we should acknowledge that. They're critical of importance. And of course, every company has kind of like the server guys that aren't too client-facing and we keep in the back, right? But the funny thing is we'll notice that the amount of facial hair also seems to increase as you move from the right brain over to the left brain. It's just science. But a lot of companies in our position, trying to be both design and development, they say, okay, we're getting this, but where's the magic? And so this is what they try and do. They're going to bring in the magic. Gandalf the Grey, he's the integrator. The problem with this is that Gandalf the Grey is the first person to get jacked up when things go really, really bad. Because they're getting it from both sides. It's an inverted power structure. So all of a sudden, design is throwing all their problems on this integrator. And development's throwing all the problems on the integrator. And they don't have this ability. What works for us as Synergy and what we've been promoting for most of my life is this, flipping it over as an inverted power structure. It's an experienced architect who's able to provide oversight. Now, what I do love about this and why it requires a fellowship is no one person was the main hero. Every single person got to be the hero at some part of the process, but it required that fellowship and it requires that little bit of magic to really help that integration so it doesn't collapse back down. And I know that there are people who don't agree with this. And you might not speak up now because we're in a room full of hybrids and designers, but we know you're out there. We can hear you mouth breathing. And the biggest reaction that we get, the biggest pushback is, Rick, you're talking unicorns. I can't build my process around unicorns. We get this all the time. You don't have to build your process around around unicorns. Ask any single other industry that uses the word architect. Ask an architect. Building buildings architect, what architect means. Every industry has this position other than software design because our problems haven't been at that complexity set that we really needed it. But we're getting to that point now. This is what architects do. Just let us do what we do is all we're asking in software design, and we're starting to get to that landscape that we needed. So I'd like to close off the talk with two questions. If you are one of these new hybrid companies, are you fostering your hybrids and promoting them to a position in your company that they can influence change? If you yourself are a hybrid in training, I'd like to ask you, do you realize that the future needs you, but not to be the lone hero that goes on, to be that corpus callosum so that the entire fellowship can truly solve the problems, because that will give us the ability to change the way people experience great software. It will really give us this ability to help people change and experience the future. Thank you very much.
All right, let's see. Where are the slides on here? Oh, it's got a star. Oh, there we go. Okay. Ah, shoot. Hey, it worked. No, it didn't work. We're losing the fonts. Bummer. Well, it was nicer before. Can you open read only? Did that work? Oh, Arturo. Arturo. Here we go. Open. Oh, yay. Okay. There we go. Okay. And I'm going to do one other thing. Whoops. Oh, if it's read-only, I can't do that. I'm stuck with my timings now. Okay, guys. This is going to be tough. All right. Well, my name is Robbie Ingerbetson. This is a talk called Farming for Ideas. And this is a talk about becoming the most creative version of you. And you can find me here, by the way. I managed to get @Ingerbetson as my Twitter handle. So this talk started off because I had an idea last August, and it was a really good idea, and I knew it. I could feel that there was something special about that idea. And I wanted to be able to do it again. I wanted to be able to repeat that process. Because I realized that if you only have one idea, it's not really worth very much. And I thought, what if I could come up with a way to have good ideas consistently, right? So that's what I'm hoping we can do today, is talk about how you can have an idea on your own schedule and you know, your own pacing when you need it and when you want it. So the first thing we need to do to begin kind of thinking about ideas this way is we need to rethink what an idea is. Normally we think about an idea as, we represent it with a light bulb, right? It's something that goes off in our head, or a lightning bolt. We talk about flashes of inspiration. But we want to rethink sort of the way, sort of our perspective on what an idea is and where they come from. The fact is that really great thinkers tell us that their ideas typically come very differently. Instead of coming all at once, they tend to come slowly. And in fact, Stephen Johnson, who wrote a book about this, said that came up with this term which he called the slow hunch. And he talked about how ideas are really made up of hunches that trickle in, and then we combine into something that eventually we remix and create something that is an actual big or good idea. Now, I don't want to take from you the fact that you can understand something in a moment, but really big original thinking tends to happen a little bit at a time. The definition I like best for an idea comes from this guy who was like a Don Draper. He was an ad guy in the 1950s and the 1960s named Steve Williams. And he said that an idea is nothing more nor less than a new combination of old elements. And I think that there's something really, really powerful in this idea because it gives us some insight into where we can find ideas. And it also teaches us this really great concept, which is that ideas generate other ideas. And that's a really powerful thing because a lot of times as you're looking for ideas, you begin to have this feeling that the ideas are all gone. The good ideas have been taken, right? But no, don't ever let yourself think that. And in fact, this is intuitive to you because if I were to ask you if you expect the pace of innovation to speed up or slow down, you would tell me it will speed up, right? And the reason for that is that we expect ideas to produce other ideas. And there's a term for this. Stephen Johnson calls this the adjacent possible. And he says that we are surrounded by possibilities, right? And that those are the ideas that are coming next. Another way of saying this is that there was no way that you could have created a microwave in 1650, right? Because the set of adjacent ideas that would have taken you there hadn't been invented yet. So you can think of these ideas as spare parts, right? There are ideas and we need to come up with new combinations for them. And as we come up with those new combinations, we produce new ideas. And if you think about these as spare parts, that's a really powerful and liberating idea because it lets you know that as you find ideas, those can become your spare parts. Those can become the things that you use to create new ideas. I think this is why really creative people are also very curious people, because they're constantly looking to find these spare parts and see how the world works so that they can create new ideas from them. So everything that we've said so far about ideas is kind of in the realm of innovation or invention. But as a designer, I want to think about ideas differently. I want to create not something that is invented, but I want to create something that evokes, something that teaches, or something that inspires, right? So a slightly different kind of thinking. And I think we can gain some insight in that as we start to talk about what makes an idea good. So if you think of an idea as a combination of two other ideas or a combination of other things, you can imagine there are some ideas that are just nonsensical, right? Like if I said, like ketchup and lampshade, for instance. That's not a good idea because it doesn't make any sense. There are also ideas that aren't good because they are too logical. So like if I said ketchup and hot dog, that's not a new idea. It's, I guess, you know, might be a delicious idea. But it's not necessarily a good idea because it's not new. The really great ideas need to have something about them that is, I guess, somewhere in between ridiculous and logical. And I would say that thing is intuitive, right? So as designers, the thing that we're looking for is something that is intuitive. So I might say ketchup and macaroni and cheese. Now, to me, I don't know about you, I have kids, but so if I say ketchup and macaroni and cheese, I immediately think of my kids. And so there's something in there that is intuitive, right? This relationship between ketchup and macaroni and cheese causes me to get to my kids. And that's the kind of thing that causes us to respond to an idea. It's the fact that it pulls us through that process. And we call this gestalt. And this is the idea that we as humans have this incredible ability to perceive things holistically. In other words, we perceive the relationships between the elements rather than perceiving the elements themselves. A great example of this is a symphony. You don't hear the individual cello notes or the individual oboe notes. You hear the relationship between those notes. And the gestalt, psychologists taught us that we do this all the time. In fact, they called this particular aspect of it closure. It's the idea that we can close in on a concept. So as a designer, that's the thing that we want to pick up on, is we want to create closure for people. So a new idea will allow them to create that closure, to close the gap, and cause them to go through something evocative on the way. And our ideas, the set of things that we can draw upon to do this, is the knowledge, the pre-existing knowledge of the person that we are trying to talk to, right? Sometimes we call this the zeitgeist. It's the stuff that we all know. It's like I think that means the ghost of the times, another German word. Maybe Marco can confirm that for us. So when we encounter the zeitgeist, that becomes the building blocks that we have as designers to begin to create ideas. You could also, from a user's perspective, say that it's the pre-existing knowledge that somebody has when they encounter the system that we're trying to design. Okay, so we skipped that slide, but the thing we want to do now is talk about the process for how you actually do this yourself. How do you get a good idea? How do you recreate that? First thing you need to do is define the thing that you're trying to create an idea around. The second thing that you need to do, Stephen Williams, he put it this way, you need to masticate the information, right? That means chew it up. You need to eat the information. So you need to take that thing that you want to make an idea about, and you need to pick it apart, chew it up, look at each individual element with a tremendous amount of detail. And the reason I think that this is important is because it allows your design to be authentic. You know, there's a lot of talk about how we as designers want to be authentic. I think that sometimes we take that internally and we think that we need to be an authentic expression of ourselves. But true authenticity and the job of a designer is to be authentic to the thing that we're designing for. And the only way we can do that is to deeply understand it. It's to pull it apart and understand the individual elements. Once we've done that, once we've taken the time and the process to learn how to be authentic to our subject, then we need to begin to expand our thinking around that subject. Expansive thinking is the process of beginning to understand the ideas that are correlated to that thing, right? A lot of times this is a mind map. A lot of times this is how we build it. The other thing that we do sometimes is we brainstorm, and I actually really love brainstorming. I'm part of a generation of kids that was taught to be creative in elementary school, right? And I think that was really powerful because my teachers valued creativity, and so I grew up learning and loving creativity. The problem is that we would use brainstorming as a tool, and the idea was that we would look for solutions, right? The more effective way to use brainstorming is to use it to do two things. First of all, to expand your network. So it needs to be collaborative. You need to bring other people in to brainstorm with you. And the other thing is to expand your concept around that thing that you're trying to understand. So instead of looking for solutions, you need to look for insights. This can be very frustrating. It can take a long time, and the problem is we want to get to solutions early, right? Like, we want to solve the problem. We want to have the big idea while we're brainstorming. I would implore you to not do that. If you are brainstorming, if you're trying to get to an idea, realize that the best solution is not going to come while you're brainstorming. This is Isaac Asimov, but 1,000 other really smart people have said the same thing, that if they have a hard problem to solve, they leave it alone. They walk away from it. Albert Einstein said that his best ideas came to him while he was shaving. I think the sort of the best explanation for why this works is an analogy to primordial ooze. So if you ever hear a biologist talk about the beginning of creation, right, they will always talk about this primordial ooze. The key component, two key components to that are, one, it was very fluid, right? Primordial ooze is fluid. So you had all this stuff floating around and they're ready to combine like ideas. The other thing is that it was random. So the thing that you want to do is you want to create an environment where your thinking can be randomized, where those ideas can bump into each other and create new ones. And then you also want it to be very fluid. You want to have the ability to think about something, let it go, think about something, let it go. This is the magic to coming up with a good idea. And the really important piece of this is that at the end of all this, you'll have ideas. In fact, a lot of people carry notebooks. You'll see creative people carrying around notebooks so they can write down those ideas as they come. The magic is that at the end of this, you need to ask a question, which is that idea good? And I'll tell you what, you will have an answer to that. And the reason is because you authentically understand the subject, and because you authentically understand the area around the subject. So you'll be able to identify good ideas at that point. So this is a summary. So we identify the thing, we deconstruct it, we go through a process of expansive thinking about it, we create randomness in which our best ideas can form, things can bounce around, those ideas can stick together, and then last of all, we evaluate whether or not it was good. So that's how you come up with a good idea. Thank you. Oh. Two quick reminders. First of all, fill out your evaluations. I guess, are you going to do the sartorial?
Yeah, just for
okay.
And I also wanted to say something. I wanted to thank everyone in the community who raised their voice at the beginning of the schedule. And thanks, everyone in the community. Can you raise your hand if you tweeted anything related? We want user experience sessions at Mix. Thank you, all of you. We really appreciate, especially Rick here, who represented the community.
It was a lot of us. It was a lot of work. Everybody here on the team, we're all passionate about it. We'd like to thank John Papa as well, yes, and Microsoft for listening, because we started this in Twitter early on. We really want to get design. Microsoft's been listening. We love the changes. There's been so many good UX sessions here, and we just want to see that keep rolling forward. Right? That's the best part about Mix, having the 72-hour conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone.